This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hi, I'm Chad Stout, and I'm a registered professional forester in California. Growing up, I was always in the woods, and I've just always had a passion for that. Now, I'm passionate about growing a sustainable working forest. What makes a working forest sustainable is growing more than what we harvest. And managing those forests to promote health, we're looking 80 to 100 years down the road. The forest that I'm working on is for my kids' kids.
Learn more at workingforestinitiative.com.
What if there was a university on the train? An accounting class under the one shady spot at soccer practice. Imagine if every waiting room was actually
the doctor, we'll see you now.
A classroom. What if you could pick the time and the place that works for you, and college would just appear? UMass Global offers 100% online classes, short 8-week courses, and personalized support to help you succeed in college, wherever you are in life. Major in your future. Visit umassglobal.edu to apply.
Welcome to The Climate Question from the BBC World Service, the show all about the burning issue of our time. And this week, we're touring the world in search of climate news. From Malawi and how banana growers are now making banana wine in response to our warming world.
In our whole life, we never thought or imagined that one day these bananas would save us.
To the United States, where President Biden has banned offshore drilling across vast areas of the country's coastline.
In a statement today, the president said, in part, quote, drilling off these coasts could cause irreversible damage to places we hold dear and is unnecessary to meet our nation's energy needs.
And traveling from Colombia all the way to Zanzibar, one humpback whale took the longest trip ever recorded. Scientists are puzzling out why he did it, but one theory put forward is global warming.
Humpback whales are known for their long migrations, feeding near the poles and breeding in warmer waters. But this male's journey was even more spectacular, involving two distant breeding grounds.
With me to dissect and discuss these big stories is the BBC's climate and science reporter, Esme Stallard. How are you? How were your holidays?
Yeah, it was good. Nice, relaxing. Took a few days off. Managed to go down to Cornwall for some cold surfing and pub trips and walks, which was lovely, much needed.
That sounds delightful. Did you spot the humpback whale, though? Because I've heard one was seen nearby.
There was, and I'm really sad I didn't get to see it. I was right on the tip of Cornwall as well, and I heard there was one seen just off the Isles of Scilly, not that far away. So really gutted didn't manage to see one this time. But apparently they are becoming more common around Cornwall, so maybe next time.
Yeah, I've always wanted to see one. Actually, any sort of whale. I've seen a minky, but that's about as exciting as it gets. Stay tuned for more whale tales, and make sure you subscribe to the Climate Question podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. But first, 2024 was another record-breaking year. The EU climate service, Copernicus, has just released its data.
The year was 1.6 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial level. 2024 was the warmest year for all continental regions except for Antarctica and Australasia, as well as for sizable parts of the ocean.
So, as Samantha Burgess, the climate lead from Copernicus, announced, the global temperature last year was 1.6 degrees hotter than pre-industrial times. It's the first time the world has breached 1.5 degrees. Here's the director of the programme, Carlo Buontempo.
Today, what we will be presenting are facts. These are not our personal opinions. And once more, they tell us unequivocally that climate keeps warming.
Overshooting 1.5 degrees Celsius is a significant moment in the world of climate. That's because back in 2015, the world signed an agreement in Paris. It stated that countries would pursue, quote, efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius, recognizing that this would significantly reduce the risks and impacts of climate change. This breach would need to happen for a number of years, though, in order for this Paris Agreement to be broken. So is this the beginning of the end? And what does it mean that we've reached this temperature so soon? One person who's been studying these numbers for years is Zeke Hausfather, journalist, scientist at Berkeley Earth, which is a non-profit that tracks global temperatures. You're also an IPCC author, very busy man. I think you're also a father. Any credentials I've missed, Zeke?
I also am the climate research lead at Stripe, which is a financial technology company. Do that as well.
Now, another hot year, another record broken. Copernicus wasn't the only organization, though, that released its data. NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the US, Berkeley Earth, and the World Meteorological Organization have all published their data. How different are the findings?
So if we look just since 1970, for example, all the records are very, very similar. Copernicus is slightly warmer than the others, but they're almost identical. It's when we go further back, when we try to calculate the amount of warming since, you know, 1850 to 1900 period that we use as a stand-in for the pre-industrial era, that we get larger differences between groups. And this is largely due to how groups choose to fill in the gaps between observations in the early part of the record. Today, we have satellites, we have buoys floating around the ocean, we have weather stations everywhere. Prior to 1900, we had a lot less data. And so the biggest uncertainties in these records isn't what's happening today. It's what happened, you know, 150 years ago. But when we want to calculate warming since pre-industrial, and we want to look at how close we are to 1.5 degrees, those differences make a big impact. So because of that, we're expecting two of the groups, NASA and NOAA, to come in just below 1.5 degrees. NASA is going to be 1.47, NOAA is going to be 1.46. So, you know, we're talking about hundredths of a degree difference here. Whereas the rest of the groups, Hadley, Berkeley, Copernicus, and then various Japanese reanalysis and temperature groups are all going to come in above 1.5 degrees. And so the majority of temperature records this year, four out of the six groups, are going to be above 1.5 degrees. And the World Meteorological Organization average that they publish, which I think is as good as any indicator of where the consensus is for the record, is going to be above 1.5 degrees for the first time this year.
I mean, the difference between 1.5 and above is significant, though, when we're talking about the Paris Agreement, isn't it? I mean, I know we have to breach it for a number of years in order for that agreement to be dead in the water. But depending on whether you look at one organization's data or another, that may have started already.
So certainly having a single year above 1.5 degrees is a worrying sign. I don't think it means that we've firmly breached the Paris target, which has been interpreted by the IPCC and others for a 20-year average period. And the reason for that is when we look at annual global temperatures, we're really dealing with two things. One is the long-term warming driven by human emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases. But the other is a fair amount of year-to-year variability, primarily driven by these El Niño and La Niña cycles of temperature in the tropical Pacific. And so you could have a year that's, you know, a tenth of a degree or two warmer than you would otherwise have because it's a strong El Niño year like we saw in 2024. And for that reason, they didn't want to make it due to natural variability that 1.5 degrees is considered firmly passed, but rather due to the long-term human-driven changes. Those we still expect to firmly pass 1.5 degrees sometime between the late 2020s and early 2030s. But I think the fact that we are already seeing a year above 1.5 degrees earlier than many of us thought is definitely a worrying sign here.
You mentioned El Niño there, and I wanted to ask you about another phenomenon, because I read a paper from the journal Nature, which you tweeted, in fact, and it was about how air pollution reductions may have also caused our planet to warm a bit. And I wonder, can you just unpack that for us?
So the last 2 years have been a bit warmer than many of us in the scientific community expected. And so there's been a big push to try to identify exactly why. And one factor that's come up again and again is that CO2 and other greenhouse gases are the major contributor to long-term warming, but there's another important factor at play here, which is our emissions of sulfur dioxide and other small particles into the atmosphere, usually as a co-product of burning fossil fuels. Now, these aerosols, as we call them, are very reflective. They bounce a lot of light back to space. They also increase cloud formation. And so over the last decade, we've seen pretty dramatic declines in aerosol emissions, both due to new shipping regulations that cut the amount of sulfur in marine fuel by 80%, and due to broader declines in South Asia, particularly in China, where the government has taken enormous efforts over the last decade to clean up the air, install scrubbers and coal-fired power plants and steel mills and similar types of measures. And because of that, human emissions of sulfur dioxide have fallen by about 40% since 2010. And that's unmasked some of the warming that had been masked by this human pollution, the sort of global dimming due to it. And so some of the warming in the last few years is likely due to reductions in human aerosol emissions unmasking greenhouse gas warming.
So, I mean, that paper suggested that some scientists are concerned that the planet is heating up at a faster pace than expected or predicted, even when you take into account things like El Nino and air pollution reductions, aerosols, that sort of thing. I mean, I want to know what your take is on that.
The one thing that is a little worrying here is there have been some recent papers suggesting that part of this increase in the rate of warming is being driven by changes in cloud behavior, particularly lower-lying clouds being less reflective. And those changes in clouds could be due to these changes in aerosol emissions and sulfur dioxide emissions, but they could also be a response to a warmer planet itself. You know, most climate models suggest that as the world warms, clouds will become a little less reflective and change in ways that enhance the amount of warming the world is experiencing. We call this the cloud feedback to climate change. But this is a big area of uncertainty for climate scientists. It's one of the reasons why when we try to predict how much warming the world is going to experience this century, it could be anywhere between 2 degrees or 4 degrees in a scenario where we don't reduce emissions quickly. And so if what we are seeing is a strong cloud feedback to warming, it might suggest that the climate is more sensitive to our emissions and that we might be in store for more warming this century. But I think the jury is still out there. How much of these cloud changes are driven by changing aerosol emissions and how much might represent a more fundamental feedback in the climate system?
Now, Zeke, a final question for you. Do you have any sense of what we're in store for in 2025?
So 2025, we all expect global temperatures to be a tiny bit cooler than 2024 as the El Nino event has faded, probably around 1.4 degrees above pre-industrial levels.
Zeke Hausfather, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it. With me throughout the show is BBC climate reporter Esme Stallard. Now, Esme, hearing this kind of news from Copernicus about 1.5 degrees Celsius being broken or breached, some people might think that this global target is now dead in the water. What do you think?
I mean, honestly, I can't think of a reason why you would get rid of it at this stage. It's certainly a way to bring countries together to give them a focal point. I mean, remember in the Paris Agreement where 1.5 is outlined, what they do say is that that's an ambition, but ultimately 2 degrees is what we really want to keep below. But in terms of just getting rid of 1.5 and saying, oh, well, we've missed that, shall we just go to the 2 degrees? I think there is concern that that would fail to focus countries. And so really, until we officially kind of pass that point in terms of the science, I certainly think the consensus seems to be that we should continue to keep that target in mind. I mean, ultimately, it shouldn't matter whether it's 1.5, 1.6, 1.7. Any increase in temperature, as we've seen this year with the level of extreme events, is not good for the planet and for the environment and for people that are living on it.
Now, you've been covering this story in the US, President Biden's ban on offshore drilling, just weeks before Donald Trump takes office.
Before leaving the White House, President Joe Biden announced an executive order that will make it difficult for President-elect Donald Trump to deliver one of his key campaign promises.
How big is Biden's ban area, and how much oil and gas will now stay in the ground as a result?
So the area he was looking to protect is part of their offshore continental area. It's basically part of the US waters, but it's beyond what they would normally fish in, say, and it's where a lot of drilling and mine development takes place. Now, the area he's wanting to protect is about 625 million acres, which is about the quarter the size of Europe. So it's not inconsequential by any means. It's a huge area that he's put under protection. There's areas up in Alaska that he's protected, all the way down to areas within the Gulf of Mexico. So quite significant, certainly.
I mean, Trump has vowed to undo any climate regulation that Biden puts in. And I wonder, what's Trump's response been?
I mean, unsurprisingly, he said, I will immediately unban these areas. You know, I'll open them up again for development.
President Biden's actions yesterday on offshore drilling, banning offshore drilling, will not stand. I will reverse it immediately. It'll be done immediately. And we will drill, baby, drill. And we're going to be drilling in a lot of other locations. And the energy costs are going to come way down.
But it's something actually that's easier said than done. A very strange part of this act that Biden has used is that it gives power to a president to protect areas, but there is no caveat or no power within this act to actually allow another president to undo those areas once they've been protected. And in fact, Trump tried to do this back in 2019, when 2017 he started trying to unban areas that Obama had protected. But a court ruled in 2019, 2 years later, that actually this act does not allow him to do that. Now, having said that, you know, he still might challenge that further. We could see that go all the way up to the Supreme Court, which we know at the moment has a majority of Republican judges, or he could go down the more extreme route, which is just to get rid of the act altogether. Now, of course, that requires input from the houses in America, which it might be more difficult for him to get agreement on. There isn't party consensus across the Republican Party on this issue. The governor in Florida and other states actually want some of their coastal areas protected. So even if he tried to abolish the act, it's not actually clear if he would get support for that.
Thank you so much, Esme. A reminder that you're listening to The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
Hi, I'm Chad Stout, and I'm a registered professional forester in California. Growing up, I was always in the woods, and I've just always had a passion for that. Now, I'm passionate about growing a sustainable working forest. What makes a working forest sustainable is growing more than what we harvest. And managing those forests to promote health, we're looking 80 to 100 years down the road. The forest that I'm working on is for my kids' kids.
Learn more at workingforestinitiative.com.
I'm Greer Jackson, and listening along and providing lots of excellent insight is the BBC's climate reporter, Esme Stallard. Now, Esme, last time I think we did a news show together, you got to try some chocolate, was that right?
I did. Yeah, it's lovely.
Nice. Have you had a banana wine before?
No, I haven't. It keeps getting better and better.
Unfortunately, I don't have any to try for you this time. But a cooperative made up of mostly women in Malawi has begun converting spoiled bananas into a rather delicious drink, or so I'm told. BBC Africa's Ashley Lime has been there in person to check it out for us.
We travelled about 600 kilometres to get here from the capital, Lilongwe. They noticed how far we'd come, and they've been waiting for us, so we were welcomed with jubilation and singing and clapping, and we joined the dance. So the women are very lively, active women, and they were dressed in very colourful attire. In Swahili, we call them kitenge. In Malawi, they say chitenge in the Chichewe tribe or language. So one of the people that we talked to is called Emily Nkana Mchenjere.
We are a women's group who are in the winemaking business. We produce wine from bananas. In our whole life, we never thought or imagined that one day these bananas would save us. But here we are. As you can see, we are very happy and healthy women. Our families too. Some of us have children in secondary schools, and we are able to pay for their school fees with the money that comes from these sales.
But it wasn't always so happy and prosperous for women like Emily, as Ashley found out.
What I can see is we are just close to Lake Malawi. We can see it from here, and we can see the way the waves are beating at the shore. That's where the former banana plantation used to be, and the plantations have been damaged by water. There's a lot of water around there. It's also swampy, and people no longer farm down there because of the effects of the rising levels of water from Lake Malawi.
Last year, the World Bank reported that the water levels in the lake were the highest in 10 years. And it points to climate change as the cause. Shorter, more intense rainy seasons are increasing runoff into the lake rather than soaking into the soil. Other papers I've read suggest that the water levels will decline in future because of climate change, land use change, and increased use of water for irrigation. Either which way, there doesn't seem to be much clarity around Lake Malawi's future. Are the lake levels rising because of climate change or not? This does really matter because the lake is so vital for fishing and for farming, but also hydropower, right, Esme?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the majority of power in Malawi, but also many of the neighbouring countries in East Africa, like Mozambique, Zambia, I went to last year, comes from hydropower. And, you know, without having that source of electricity, then it affects farming, it affects schooling, it affects the economy, it affects key infrastructure and services like hospitals. But not only that, the longer this goes on where they're not able to rely on hydropower, you do see countries like Zambia looking for alternatives like coal, like burning wood, which just simply increases emissions further and seeks to exacerbate the problem. And really, they had a very green electricity grid until climate change seemed to exacerbate the issue.
As we always say on the climate question, and as you do in your reporting, Esme, it's often the people who have done the least to cause climate change that are feeling the effects most. And in Emily's case, the water swallowed their banana plantation and they had to move inland and uphill away from rising waters. But there they encountered a different problem, likely worsened by climate change, extreme heat.
We relocated here from the old farm, but that came with another challenge. Up here we have way too much heat from the sun, and all this makes our bananas ripen very fast. That was the main reason that we decided to find an alternative to wasting all the ripe bananas and venture into wine production as a business. When the bananas are ripe, we take them to the factory where we produce this top quality wine.
Ashley, overripe bananas, you can pick them and turn them into banana wine. What's that process like? Have you seen it in action?
Yes, we have actually seen the process going on. So what happens is that they pick the bananas from their farms, they wash them, they grade them according to those that are viable for production, and then they count how many bananas they need. Then they peel them, cut them into pieces, wait for boiled water to cool down because they need to purify the water. They add sugar, they add yeast, lemon, and they wait for 3 days. Then they remove the lemon rinds, and then it stays for about 21 days for the maturity of the wine. And then from there, they keep on sieving it every week for 6 months until it's purified, so that it's now wine that can be consumed.
Do people buy it? Is it popular?
Yeah, people buy it. In fact, we were actually informed by one of the officials here that the former president, Peter Mutharika, is a customer here. So he sends his representative every time to come and buy the wine because he loves it. It's sweet.
This banana wine cooperative has meant that members, like Emily, are financially more secure and better able to cope with climate shocks when they come. It's also why she now farms a range of crops, tomatoes, pumpkins, spinach, maize and groundnuts, on top of making banana wine, to ensure she can always put food on the table, even if one crop fails.
Even though we encounter so many challenges, we keep going. We are a group of dedicated women who will do anything to sustain our families, educate our children and empower lives, all thanks to bananas. We can now afford to eat a healthy diet.
Ashley, I can't let you leave without tasting the wine for us and telling us what it's like. Have you got some to hand? Is it yellow?
It looks brownish, I think. It is, let me taste it. Oh, wow, it is sweet. It is smooth. It has some banana taste from afar. Wow, I think I would take this.
Certainly feeling merry after a little sip of that. Well, Ashley, thank you so much for travelling all that way and telling us all about this banana wine find.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it. It's lovely to hear.
You're welcome.
literally left speechless after one sip of banana wine. It did sound like she enjoyed that, didn't she, Esme?
It sounded rather delicious, yeah. I think we should probably left her with the bottle.
I know they took some back to Kenya with them, and they did say they'd send some in the post, but none has made it here, unfortunately. But what I really love is that it's just such a creative solution to the climate crisis. And finally, I mentioned before this amazing male whale who set sail on the most impressive journey. And I've been following the story so closely, and I've asked you to take a look at it as well, Esme. He started, or at least was photographed, in Colombia, then in Zanzibar 5 years later. That, if you map it out, is a minimum of 13,000 kilometres. I want to know, does this amazing whale have a name, and will he go in the Guinness Book of World Records?
No, he has no name, sadly. Maybe we should give him one here live on the climate question. It seems to be the longest one documented. I mean, there wasn't a tracker put on him or anything like that, though. Photos were sent in of lots of whales around the world to scientists, and they managed to identify that he was seen back in 2017 off the Pacific coast of Colombia, and then popped up 5 years later off the coast of Zanzibar. So if anyone's geography is good, that's kind of a very, very long way, passing multiple continents. And 13,000 kilometres is actually the kind of smallest distance they mapped he could have gone. It is far more likely he took a circuitous route, and actually it was significantly more than that. So very, very impressive.
Yeah, and how they worked it out is really interesting, isn't it? I didn't quite realise that humpback whales have different shapes and patterns on their tails or flukes. I don't even know what the flukes are, but I wrote it down, so I'm going to say it anyway. Therefore, artificial intelligence can look at all those pictures and then say, yes, this is the same whale.
Yeah, they have this fantastic website named thehappywhale.com, and just people all over the world, members of the public, you can just take a photo and send it in. And yeah, as you said, the whale's tails, God, that's a bit of a mouthful, they're kind of like fingerprints. They're unique to the whale. And so, as you said, they were able to identify that this was the same whale popping up in these two locations, and therefore could map their movements around the globe. But I think it's a fantastic story of citizen science coming together.
I know you didn't define what a fluke is. Does that mean you don't know what a fluke is either?
I think it's the little bits that go down in the middle of the tail.
I've just Googled it. A whale's fluke is a two-lobed tail of a whale,
with each
lobe called a fluke. Congratulations.
Oh, thank goodness
You're
for
right.
that.
So why did he do this? Are there any theories?
There's a few theories floating around. I mean, humpback whales in general undertake massive migrations anyway. It's not unusual. They've been recorded many times to be swimming in excess of a few thousand miles. And the reason they do that is they like to breed in tropical waters where it's a bit warmer. And then they feed often in the cooler areas where there's abundance of krill, which is the thing they feed on, which prefers to be under the ice. So they think it was due to the fact that he was trying to find food. Now, the reason why he travelled so far potentially for that could be the fact that climate change is warming the ocean waters, which could have driven the krill into new areas. But remember, there are many things that affect whales, not just climate change. There's also fisheries, getting hit by ships, underwater noise pollution, again from ships. So it can be difficult to kind of identify that it's specifically climate change that is affecting them. But there's another way we can look at it as well, and that's in terms of their breeding rate. So I mentioned that they prefer to breed in tropical waters, but there is a limit to that. They don't tend to like breeding kind of above 28 degrees. And research by the University of Hawaii back in 2022 found that at current kind of rates of warming, more than a third of their humpback whales breeding areas would be above that upper limit. So it's affecting their food supply, but also affecting where they can breed, so fully across their kind of life cycle.
Well, Esme, thank you so much. Thank you also to our production team, Diane Richardson, Ellie House, Sophie Eastor, Simon Watts, Tom Brignall, and James Beard. Don't forget, you can ask us your climate question and we'll hopefully answer it on a future show. The email is theclimatequestion@bbc.com or WhatsApp us on +44 8000 321 71. Both those contact details are on our website and also in our podcast description. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Hi, I'm Chad Stout, and I'm a registered professional forester in California. Growing up, I was always in the woods, and I've just always had a passion for that. Now, I'm passionate about growing a sustainable working forest.
What makes a working forest sustainable is growing more than what we harvest. And managing those forests to promote health, we're looking 80 to 100 years down the road. The forest that I'm working on is for my kids' kids.
Learn more at workingforestinitiative.com.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.